So thank you for two very interactive lectures yesterday. I think it's a fantastic situation to be in when you're not going to be able to cover all the material you hope, because it's been a very engaged and interactive experience. So please keep that up. And also, as I said, I think that I've structured the lectures so that the start of it, I really wanted to focus on what we really know, and I think that's the most important part of this. The other part's about what we hope. I mean, this is me injecting a lot of my bias into that. So I'm happy to spend less time talking about that than the actual parts of this that we know. So hopefully you all had a chance to think about exactly why. I mean, I can say, you know, the real recap of lecture one is that what we had was that there's overwhelming evidence for dark matter, and everything that is in a particle, we'll see where the inverted commas come from later in this lecture, appears to be inconsistent with the data. But of course, the other thing that I hope you took away from the first lecture is my favorite unit conversion between a solar mass and a GeV, and I hope you've all had a chance to think about why the proton mass is on the denominator here, and I'd be delighted to talk to any of you about this later on. So what we started talking about yesterday but didn't finish up is that, of course, I mean, the evidence tells us that there is something that has mass and gravitates, that is this dark matter. And certainly historically, the first things people thought about were not particles. But slowly, every other possibility was eventually deemed inconsistent with the data that we had. And we had to start taking very seriously that dark matter could be a particle. And then what we started diving into was the vast landscape over which, supposed to be a straight line, dark matter could exist. Going all the way down from roughly 10 to the minus 21 eV, somewhere in the middle, where the proton mass is at about a GeV, and all the way up here, where we had a solar mass. And what we started talking about in the last lecture was this classic window. So this area where the dark matter has a mass comparable to the states that we have in the Standard Model. And for example, we spent some time talking about the WIMP, and we ended on discussing how direct detection operates and how the way that we've classically used direct detection starts to fail dramatically below a GeV. So if dark matter had a mass of order an MeV, we'd need something completely revolutionary, and that's an idea that's really active in the community at the moment. So what I want to do today is finish up our discussion of this classics window and sort of determine what is the lower edge of this. This is the KeV window, which is telling us why, essentially what we'll answer in this question here is why neutrinos can't be the dark matter of our universe, because otherwise they're an excellent candidate. But what I want to do after that is move to the heavy window and explore the possibility of how dark matter could be all the way up to maybe a solar mass, and then look at the light window where dark matter behaves as a wave. So after that, as I said, in some terrible world where I hadn't been asked a single question here, then what I would have talked about was the WIMPs, and then I would have talked about axions. But maybe my current thinking is that I will say just a few words about WIMPs and then skip over that, because it's quite well-trodden territory, and move on to axions. But I'll take a vote when I'm at the end of the material I wanted to cover here, in case I've just completely misread the room. Good. Okay, so that's the overview. Let's now turn to our continued discussion of these classics and look at... Previously, we talked about GV to order 100 TeV, that was the WIMPs. Then we look below that, these are the light dark matter candidates that maybe go down to order an MeV. What I want to look at now is how do we sort of define the lower edge of this classic window? And of course, there's some slosh in all of the numbers that I'm putting here. But before I start talking about that bound, is there any questions that have come up since yesterday or about where we're going with this?
So you only play with maths.
Good. So what other properties might you be thinking about? What else would you like me to play with, for example? It's a fair question. I'm not trying to be facetious. Yeah.
Spin.
Exactly. Yeah. So actually, the first thing we're talking about here will be related to spin. So spin is, of course, I mean, in the PDG, spin's the first thing that's listed there. So maybe you could have focused on that. But I think that mass is a slightly more... I mean, for the spin, there's only so many things you can enumerate there, right? But with the mass, there's this enormous window that we can consider. And of course, you can then, for the different spins that you can have, as you'll soon see, there are different mass windows that you can associate with this. So there's more meat when you come to talking about the mass. But the other thing I'd want to have in the PDG entry for dark matter is, of course, all the couplings it has. And I hope that there's a large list of those of the Standard Model, but none have been found yet beyond gravity. Please, there's another question.
Orbital angular momentum. It can create gravitation, right?
I mean, you're talking about the spin, sorry, or?
No, orbital angular momentum.
You're meaning if you have like some, I mean, to define that, I need to have some multiple states, right? I mean, the intrinsic angular momentum associated with a single particle is the spin, but if you want to add in some orbital angular momentum, I need some system, right?
Yes.
So I'm starting out with just talking about the particle. Of course, we suspect that there are many of those out there, and this system will have some orbital angular momentum associated with this. I mean, I guess to sort of push in the direction that you're saying here, there's a lot more that can be described about dark matter than just what I'm doing here, but I just want to understand the absolute basic properties of it and show you that even if we restrict to that, we are still honestly quite ignorant, but this is where we're at. Good. Any last questions? Okay. And also, I know there was obviously some mishaps yesterday, but please, for the people online, don't feel discouraged from asking questions despite of that. So please feel free to jump in anytime you feel, especially if it's a constructive comment. Okay. So in particular, the sort of specific candidate I'm going to be describing here is what you would call sterile neutrinos, which you can think about is are heavier cousins of the neutrinos, and the reason they have to be heavier we'll come to right now. Because there's something, a really beautiful result in physics called the Tremaine gun bound, which is what I want to walk you through here. So now let's move away from just thinking about the mass and associate a specific angular momentum to the dark matter, and say we're talking about a fermion, okay? We're talking about a specific class of these. So if we're talking about a fermion, there's actually going to be a lower limit to the mass of the fermion that you can have. And the reason for this is that fermions obey the Pauli exclusion principle. So I try and pack a whole bunch of them into a volume, I'll find that there's some limit to how many I can fit in there. They can't overlap. And then if I think about looking out in the universe, I see these dark matter halos. I have evidence for these. They have some mass and some size associated with them. But I can compute how many of these fermions can I put into that volume. And then if I multiply that number by the mass of this state, I can compare the mass I get to this from the mass of the halo. And if it's smaller than what I actually observe, then it's completely implausible that that fermion could have been the dark matter of our universe. So intuitively, that's how the argument goes, but then I'll run through it in slightly more detail, a slightly different way of deriving it here. But this is what the intuition is behind the Tremaine gun bound. We're really trying to leverage some fundamental properties of the Fermi-Dirac statistics of fermionic dark matter. Good. So let's consider some halo that has a mass m, and it has a radius r, okay? So one way of thinking about it is packing these fermions in, but another way of, it turns out, deriving essentially exactly the same result is we know that if we pack them all in, then the fermion at the edge of this thing will have some energy associated with it. Well, there'll be a distribution of energies of the fermions in there, and there'll be some maximum energy, some minimum, there's like a supremum or word like this that I haven't done math for so long that I'm forgetting, but there's like a minimum maximum energy that the system could have, which is the Fermi energy. I'm sure someone can come up with a much better description of that than I just did. So we can look at what is the Fermi energy. So we know that there definitely will be fermions in this system with that energy. And the Fermi energy, I have to remind myself, let me remind you. So M chi here is the mass of dark matter. And it depends on the number density of fermions that we have in this system here. And this is just the expression that we have for this. So what is the number density of this? Well, it's the number of fermions that you have divided by the volume of the halo, which we can determine from the fact that we treat these as spherical and it has a radius r. Now, I'm going to posit that the energy of these states at the edge is non-relativistic. Of course, you can come back and check this, but I'll tell you that it's a very, for what we're looking at here, it's a very good approximation. And so whatever this energy is, I can map this over to a velocity, a Fermi velocity, for these most energetic fermions that are in this system. So why is this an interesting velocity to compute? Well, this is some gravitational system. It has some escape velocity associated with it. If I compute the velocity of these energetic fermions, if they turn out to be larger than the escape velocity, then they wouldn't have been bound to the system and it would break apart. So this is going to be some sort of boundary between where this system starts to break itself apart because of the energy that these states must have due to Fermi-Dirac statistics. It turns out the result you would get just from the packing argument is exactly the same. It's just a few more lines to derive that. So what I want to compute is I want to take this and from this derive what the Fermi velocity is. I'll pull this back down in a second. So for whatever reason, I'm now keeping track of factors that I threw out the window very quickly yesterday. And what I want to demand is that for this system to not just be breaking apart, that this has to be less than the escape velocity of this system, which is 2gm over r square rooted. So now I have a consistency condition for this thing not to break apart, and what I can use this to determine is a limit on the mass. Okay? So there's a bit of rearrangement that goes associated with this, and that's what I want to do in a second. Please, go ahead.
The pressure we can get to break this bound state is just coming from this velocity, or we also need to consider, for example, degeneracy pressure?
Oh, in general, think about this for a second.
I ask you because you're using this Fermi energy, and I'm used to use that when the system is in degeneracy.
So if you need, of course, when the, I mean, another way of thinking about this is if the system has multiple states associated with it, you can pack each of those states before you have to move on to the next one, right? So this is something you need to account for. In what I'm doing here, I've not included any additional internal degrees of freedom that you can potentially put on top of that. However, again, I know I'm keeping track of factors that I'm being a bit loose with here, but in terms of the bound that we're going to end up getting, unless you put in many, many orders of magnitude of internal degrees of freedom, you can't, I mean, in the mass parameter space that we're looking at, you'll find that you'd need to put in a large number of internal degrees of freedom to move this around, right? I mean, generally, you might expect a couple of internal degrees of freedom, right, which would give some order one change to the bound that I'm getting. It's not going to change it parametrically, is the spirit of what I'm saying, but you're absolutely right. Generally, you do need to include the internal degrees of freedom here, and here I'm just assuming that this is a fermion with 1 degree of freedom. Great point, thank you.
I have a question.
Please, yes.
How do the units work out in the first?
I hope they do, but let's check. Okay. So just working in electron volts, right? So this is a density, so it has units of E cubed, right? And so then raised to the 2/3 power, this is E squared, and then it will cancel with that and it gives energy. But good, thank you for keeping me honest. Yeah, excellent. And that's an energy too. Very good.
Is this an energy?
I beg your pardon? I'm just working in natural units here to keep track of this. Yeah, yeah. Of course, you can move between natural units, AU and kiloparsecs from the last lecture. Yeah. So let's, this is something I did offline, but then let's use this inequality to rearrange to determine what bound we get on the dark matter mass. And you can see, in order to satisfy this, I have to make the dark matter mass larger because it's appearing on the denominator on the right-hand side. So it's going to be a lower bound on the dark matter mass. And again, for reasons that I regret, but I'll keep with this, I've kept all of the factors here. Over 1. And then all to the 1/8th power, which is what you have here. So now the bound that I'm going to get depends on the specific halo that I'm studying. So I can look at objects that have a given halo mass and a given radius, for instance, to try and determine what bound we get. Just to give you a flavor for this, I mean, one halo we talked about a lot last time was the Milky Way. And I told you that the Milky Way has a halo mass of about 10 to the 12 solar masses. And it has a radius of roughly 200 kiloparsecs. So if I put in what bound do I get out on the dark matter mass from this, please feel free to check this. I find that whatever the dark matter mass is, to be able to not just have the Milky Way halo blowing itself apart, the mass has to be greater than 5 electron volts. So this already, one second, this already tells us, for example, that whatever the dark matter is, it can't be a neutrino. But otherwise, I mean, neutrinos are excellent dark matter candidates. They have mass, they gravitate, they're electrically neutral, and they only interact very weakly with the standard model. So it's only through arguments like this that we slowly learnt that actually the neutrinos couldn't be the dark matter of our universe. Actually, I can't remember exactly, but it was quite late that we were able to, with cosmology, that we were able to bound the tau neutrino mass, for example, because that's a very hard thing to probe experimentally. So it's only quite late that we were sure that the tau neutrino, for example, wasn't dark matter. I still believe people were talking about that as a possible dark matter candidate in the mid-90s. But through these sorts of arguments, and through the fact that we knew that the tau neutrino couldn't have arbitrarily large mass, or we would have seen it show up in cosmology, we eventually ruled that out. Please, there was a question, yes.
Yeah, I was thinking, what happens if we measure the amount of dark matter in each galaxy with a certain profile? And we find that there are very small galaxies that maybe don't have dark matter because they break this. Can we kind of estimate the possible mass for the dark matter? Matter candidate, just because of maybe these galaxies seem not to have bound.
It's a very interesting thought. I mean, just to say, so the first thing that you're pushing in the right direction is that we can do better than the Milky Way with this bound. And this was going to be my next point. We have to look at other objects. And it turns out that this is a very, very weak bound. You can do three orders of magnitude better than this. I'll show you in a second by looking at better objects, which is pushing the direction you're saying. But just in terms of, again, to think about why it's a bit difficult to look for galaxies without dark matter. If you remember, if there was no dark matter seed for this thing to form, then this structure shouldn't have ever collapsed in some senses, right? So you need that dark matter seed to have ended up getting this nonlinear structure that emerged, which is what galaxies eventually come from. There are counterexamples to that. For example, I talked about all the various objects that are orbiting around the Milky Way. One example of these is something called globular clusters, which are collections of stars. And it's unclear at the moment as to whether they have a dark matter halo associated with them. In fact, I believe, I'm not an expert on this, but I believe we do not know for certain how globular clusters formed. One hypothesis is that the gas that collapsed in to form the Milky Way galaxy, if there were just small overdensities in that gas, as this whole thing was collapsing, the gas itself could form a bound system which just had baryons. But yeah, it's a very open question. Is there any dark matter in globular clusters, and how much could there be? However, even though those could be dark matter-free galaxies, it's not inconsistent with anything that we're talking about from dark matter because it depends on that specific structure formation. But it's a very interesting line of thinking.
Excuse me.
Please, yeah.
I think there is another argument against neutrino being dark matter,
though, yeah,
which is related to a structure formation. If neutrino was dark matter,
be hot. Yeah.
It's
hot. So this is the problem with that. You are correct. And the reason I didn't raise that argument here is that the way that people ultimately showed that really was with numerical simulations. So actually, initially, people were very seriously thinking that the neutrinos could be dark matter, and then one of the ways that was ruled out. I can't remember exactly when the Tremaine-Gunn bound was written down, but people just did very early numerical simulations, I think in the late 80s or early 90s, and saw that hot dark matter gave very different structure to cold dark matter. However, we didn't know what the tau neutrino mass was. Maybe it was much heavier, and then that would make it slightly colder, and if it could then be cold enough to be consistent. Because I'm about to tell you that a viable dark matter candidate is just a heavier neutrino. This is the so-called sterile neutrino. So that argument didn't rule out the tau neutrino until we had a better constraint on its mass. But of course, you're right, there are other constraints on this as well. Thank you. One and then two, yeah.
Just about the neutrino, can we say that the neutrinos are relativistic, right? So the dark matter has to be non-relativistic.
Well, so in the early universe, they might have been born relativistic, but the energies are redshifted away if they're relativistic. And then even once they become non-relativistic, their peculiar velocities redshift away as well. So in the late universe, they can still cool down, even if they're born relativistic. So dark matter could have been born relativistic, and in many models is, but eventually cools down to form the structure that we see. So that's not necessarily inconsistent a priori. Please, there was a question. That was the same. Okay, very good.
Yeah, just adding to that, I think they've done dark matter production. Universe and the bounds for the mass of a neutrino don't really coincide with the mass of a neutrino, so I don't think a neutrino is possible to lose all the dark matter in the universe.
Yeah, I agree with that statement. Yeah.
Small question.
Please, yeah.
So if we start with the given setup and dispersion relation, from a statistical mechanical point of view, I can go ahead and try to calculate heat capacity at low T. So there, for instance, I guess if I'm not mistaken, the temperature dependence should have a power T to the 3 over 2 for our case. Okay, so...
I'll take your word for that. I don't remember.
It might be wrong, but what I'm trying to say is there are a lot of different particles or other things that share the same property as a temperature dependence. So For instance, can we consider a quasi-particle as a candidate for dark matter?
What do you mean like an anion or something like that? Or sorry, what do you mean by a quasi-particle?
What I know from a past exercise, for instance, there are bosonic particles called magnons, and
uh-huh.
they share some other things
So yeah, the answer is yes. So people, to give you an example of this, people have, well, it's sort of related. People think that, have written, made arguments that dark matter in halos could actually be in some superfluid state. So in the cases that I'm studying here, I'm always just treating the simplest thing where you just think of this as some gas. But of course, I mean, we know in our own world that as we put a whole bunch of particles together, famously fermions, we get all sorts of interesting structures that emerge. This is a largely untapped field in dark matter, other than these papers that have been discussing the possibility that dark matter is in a superfluid state, for example. But yeah, that literature will be where I'd look for that. It's a very interesting possibility. So just to push on this, and this was already mentioned earlier on, I mean, this was just a very naive bound you get from this, but I think it's interesting because it already excludes the neutrinos. If you go and do a detailed analysis, you can do much better by looking at some of the dwarf galaxies in particular, and you end up finding, I think, let me just leave it at this, that it has to be heavier than a few keV, in fact. And so this is where this is setting this lower boundary of a keV. If the dark matter is a fermion, then it has to be heavier than a keV. And so that already tells you when we come to the last part of the discussion today, what we're talking about for dark matter, it has to be a boson. So the spin definitely plays some role in here, but I mean, it's sort of secondary to the landscape I'm focusing on. However, and maybe as Brian talked about in his lectures, I mean, we have reasons to believe that there could be other neutrino-like states in the Standard Model. That's one of the easiest ways that we have of generating the observed neutrino masses with so-called right-handed neutrinos. And if they had a mass of order of keV, they could be an excellent dark matter candidate. So that's exactly what the sterile neutrinos are. And how would you go and search for these? I mean, let me not say too much about this because it's a long story in and of itself. But one way that's close to my heart is that you can, if you have one of these sterile neutrino states, through a W loop, you can emit a photon. And because this is heavier than the active neutrinos, you can have a two-body decay where the sterile neutrinos decay to a photon and the active neutrino, for example. And so because this thing has a mass of order a keV, then what you'd be looking for is a photon with energy keV, which is in the X-ray band. And so actually, a combination of improving these sorts of warmness bounds to push the mass higher and higher, and covering the parameter space with these X-ray bounds, means that I think largely the possibility that sterile neutrinos is dark matter is pretty much excluded. Now, that is in the most vanilla versions of these models. Of course, theorists are sufficiently clever that they can usually add some complication to the early universe about what's happening with this and how it's produced. However, if you just stick to the simplest instances of sterile neutrinos, in the last few years, a combination of these two bounds largely rule out that possibility. Please.
Can't you play with the mixings between sterile and massive states?
Not only can you must. Yeah, absolutely. Because, for example, what I haven't gone through here, but just to say, like, how do we think the sterile neutrinos emerged in the early universe? It's the simplest version, or the earliest version of something that is described as freeze-in. So we know that all the other standard model states were in equilibrium in the early universe, but maybe the sterile neutrinos weren't reheated into, but you could still produce them by the active neutrinos oscillating into the sterile neutrinos. And then how many of them you produce would depend upon what the mixing angle is between these two states here. But then that same mixing angle will also enter here and impact that decay rate. And the thing is, you can't make the mixing angle arbitrarily small, or you wouldn't have produced enough of these particles in the early universe to be dark matter. So then there's like this finite window that you can cover, and I mean, this is an interesting story that I'm not doing justice here, and so that window is now largely excluded, unless you do something interesting in the early universe.
What happens if you have a hidden interaction?
Sure, so people have played those games, adding in new neutrino interactions in this. You can open up a little bit more parameter space, but still a lot of it is excluded. Now, if you do more dramatic changes to the picture I just told you, you can resuscitate some of this. But the simplest version of sterile neutrinos that people were very excited about in the 90s and the early 2000s now are largely excluded. Yeah. Please.
Why in the calculating related to Fermi energy, you use non-relativistic formula?
Yes, yeah.
Why?
because dark matter is, I mean, in halos has to be non-relativistic or it wouldn't have clustered. I mean, you can also then, for the value you get at the end, you can just check, what V did I get out of this? Put in the numbers. Was it non-relativistic? So there's a self-consistency check that I'm not nuts. But, I mean, if that wasn't the case, you're in violent trouble, right? Yeah, yeah. Good. Okay, so, I mean, stellar neutrinos are a very interesting candidate, but it's one the field has largely gone on, and you're the next generation, so maybe move somewhere else. But that's my statement on this. Please.
Does this assume that all the dark matter in the halo is of this particular kind?
Absolutely. No, it's a very good point. So depending on what your prior is for the UV, I know that there are many people in our community who subscribe to what is sometimes called like a cocktail model, where the UV could be so complicated that you could easily end up with the dark matter of our universe being a combination of various different different types of particles. For example, like last time I mentioned briefly that we know gross things about roughly 100% of dark matter. Like it can't be that dissipative, for example. But a small fraction of dark matter might be dissipative, like I was mentioning these possibilities. And this is a very interesting direction people think about. Like maybe dark matter has properties that we've overlooked for so long, even if it's some small structure, if it leads to a unique signature that we can see, that might be how we get some feeling for the dark sector. But I think from sort of just a minimalistic point of view, people usually stick to the hypothesis that it's 100% at a time, but there's no reason that has to be the case. Yeah, very good point. Yes?
Sorry, just a formal thing.
Uh-oh, yeah.
This nu s is a mass state?
Oh, good.
Because it's nothing, it cannot relate to the W.
So,
it should be.
What I'm talking about here, though, if I'm looking at this active thing, what I want to compute is the decay rate of the mass eigenstate, right? Yeah, that's what I want to compute, but of course, you need to keep track of these things as you normally do for neutrinos, yeah. So let me leave, this is the last thing I wanted to say about the classic window. I think there's still, it still could be that something like a stellar neutrino is correct, although you'd probably have to come up with a more complicated early universe scenario for this, which may just be how the universe is. But also, as I mentioned, I still think in the WIMP window, there are very interesting targets that we'll hit in the coming decades. So although it's really well-trodden territory, I don't think we should completely give up on it. However, I think as a community, we've seen that a lot of the parameter space we wanted to cover has been covered. And so I think that's really re-energized the community to think, well, maybe the mass of dark matter is just nothing like what we see in the standard models, and we should push to the other extremes. So that's what I want to do now. And I'll start out by looking to the right, where we have heavier dark matter.
Can I just keep you? Classical for a bit.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. We'll go very classical at the end. Yeah.
Something about this neutrino flaw, which seems this air of health that the WIMP detectors are now reaching the level where they're going to be.
I could say a lot about this, but let me keep this brief. So we drew this diagram yesterday, right, where we had the mass and the cross-section, and I showed that it looks, it's like power law here, it's an exponential here, and for xenon it peaks at like 30 GeV. There's still, I might be misremembering this, but one or two orders of magnitude away from it, what it's now been rebranded as the neutrino fog, not the neutrino flaw, because in principle you can somewhat see through it, is why people say this. And as they get closer to it, they're very nervous about calling it a flaw, I believe, is the reason this has occurred. It would be wonderful for them to get there, because there are still, for example, there are some minimal dark matter models that actually sit between the boundary of what you would call the fog and what we've got here. And for those of you who haven't thought about this before, what is happening here is that we have various neutrinos flying throughout the universe. Eventually, they also have some probability of causing a nuclear recoil. You just need to get to extremely small cross-sections in order to see this. But these instruments are becoming so obscenely sensitive that you actually could get to this. So this is sort of an irreducible background these detectors will hit. And even if you start to get there, you're then going to quickly be limited by how well we understand this population of neutrinos. So I think you can't push through this fog arbitrarily, despite the name change. But the thing I would say is that, I mean, in the community, people say, oh, that's the irreducible flaw. I worry that there could be flaws before this. Like for example, xenon, I mean, the dominant background is radon, which is they have very, very small amounts of it, but the sensitivities they're pushing here, I remember yesterday I mentioned it's 10 to the minus 46 centimeters. That's obscene. Getting rid of the radon is not something that they have established. And this is still more than an order of magnitude larger than what you would get from the neutrino fog. So if they can't get rid of that, that's going to be their dominant background, for example. I mean, there are these, there have been other proposals like moving away from xenon and looking at something else, and then maybe they can do better with this, but it would be already an enormous achievement to reach the fog, and I don't think we can take it for granted necessarily. But yeah, there's a lot more that can be said about this. Thanks. Okay, so let's push heavier. And in particular, being very loose, what I'm talking about for the heavy dark matter window is from 100 TeV all the way up to 10 to the 57 GeV, which is a solar mass here. So let's just go through some of the probes that we had for this classic window, especially for the WIMPs we talked about, and see how they're going to fare. Well, as I mentioned, you can probe WIMPs at colliders. But I think, well, I'm optimistic that in my lifetime we can get up somewhere around here, but it will be towards the very end of my lifetime. And pushing much above 100 TeV is just not going to happen for a few generations at least, it seems. So let's just put colliders out of the way. The next one we talked about was direct detection. And recall we discussed yesterday, it was helpful I drew this, that the reason that this cross-section is getting larger, not dropping off, is because the number density of particles passing through some area is dropping as 1 over m, because we know the local mass density, and so the number density decreases if we increase the mass of the particle. And so eventually, with direct detection, the challenge you run into is you can actually run up to m Planck, I said, terrestrially, because from memory, I think we computed a 1 meter squared box has about a 1 in 3 chance of a Planck scale mass particle passing through it. But as we get much heavier than this, well, we're in trouble, because there's just no particles ever pass through our instrument. So no matter how sensitive we make it, you're still not going to see anything. So direct detection does work for some part of this, and indeed, I think in some discussions after the talk yesterday, we were saying, like, where do you cut this here? And in principle, you really can push it all the way up to roughly the Planck mass. And there are analyses done by xenon and other instruments trying to search for signatures of extremely heavy dark matter, because they can be quite different to what you have at the light end. But it won't cover the entire range. Nonetheless, in principle, if this particle, especially if it could decay, indirect detection just keeps working. I computed at one stage for for an outreach talk that if dark matter has a mass of m Planck and it decays, the amount of energy that injects is equivalent to the amount of energy that's released when 500 kilograms of TNT goes off. And the fact is, you push that energy into subatomic particles. It's not a chemical reaction that's occurring here. So you can produce some obscenely energetic particles flying throughout the universe. And as you might know, we've seen some very energetic particles. There's like this cricket ball that has the kinetic energy, this proton that has the kinetic energy of a cricket ball, for example, that people had seen hitting the atmosphere. So these are the sorts of techniques that you might try and use to search for extremely heavy dark matter decaying. It'll be injecting these obscenely energetic particles throughout the universe, and that is one plausible detection strategy. So I won't go into that in detail, but just to say this is how you could search for it. What I do want to talk about was that the reason why I put these inverted commas around particle up here, and this was already alluded to, I think, in a question from yesterday. I mean, at some point around here, this notion of particle is starting to become a bit suspicious, and let's just make that slightly more rigorous. So what happens here? Let's think about various spatial scales that we can associate with the particle. So I'm just going to be very loose with this. I mean, feel free to ask me about the factors of two, but as usual, I'll be a bit flippant with them. So one spatial scale we can always associate with a particle is that it's got an intrinsic Compton wavelength associated with it, right? And just to make the units match, we know that the Compton wavelength is inversely proportional to the mass here. And so it's going to be going down as we make the mass heavier and heavier. But then, of course, I mean, this has already been alluded to, so I won't put any suspense. There's another spatial scale we can put with some associated with some object with mass. And that is, of course, it can have some attributed Schwarzschild radius. Let me just call that RS. And that is going up. And so then you can ask the question, well, what happens when the Compton wavelength of the particle matches the Schwarzschild radius? At that point, if I try and make the mass heavier, well, then the notion over which I would describe the particle is within the associated Schwarzschild radius. And so it seems reasonable then that I should no longer think about what I'm describing as a particle. Instead, I should think about it as a black hole, for example. But we can just compute where this occurs. It's useful to keep track of the... not to work in natural units here, so I'll keep track of h bar and c. So just to remind you, that's the definition of the Compton wavelength. And this 2 pi comes in because I'm working with h bar here, whereas normally this is written in terms of just the standard Planck constant. And I'm just matching this to the Schwarzschild radius, which is 2g m chi over c squared. Yeah.
What's the difference between Compton wavelength and the Broglie wavelength?
So one, the difference is essentially what is the speed of that particle or the momentum of it, right? So the de Broglie wavelength, you replace m essentially with p, right? So in principle, if you wanted to, and usually if you're thinking about some object like the spatial scale over which it varies, the more natural thing to think about is the de Broglie wavelength.
Right.
But if I want to put that aside and not think too carefully about what is the speed of the particle I'm studying, it's more natural to look at this from a Compton wavelength. But the sort of thing that you're pushing at here is that there's some order one slop in what I'm doing this, right? Somewhere around here, the notion of where I should think about this as a particle into a black hole, I'm not being exactly precise with this, but I know it should be somewhere around M Planck. But I think being too precise about this is already, actually having a dark matter, like an individual particle that has a mass right near the Planck scale, I mean, we would probably, to fully understand what's going on there, you would also think you'd want to understand exactly what's happening in quantum gravity, which we don't. So I'm not too worried that I don't know absolutely precisely where this transition would occur, because I have no idea what's happening at that transition exactly anyway. Just to know that there has to be some breakdown is all I can say for certain.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's like the Broglie would be MV rather than MC, but anyway, that's...
Good, you'll probably... if it's non-relativistic, but if it's relativistic, you can just put the momentum there.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But then I would have to specify what the velocity of this thing is. I don't want to do that, so let me just put this here. Yeah. So if I put these together, I'll put the m's to the other side, I'm going to have to take a square root. What I will get, dropping all the factors of 2 in the other detail, and the factor of pi, no, the factors of 2 cancel, I'm just dropping a pi. I find exactly the Planck scale, I mean, just by definition, which is 10 to the 19 GeV. But if you converted this to kilograms, it's not grams specifically, it's not a particularly large value. I mean, it is for subatomic particles, but it's only 20 micrograms, right? For example, I am heavier than 20 micrograms considerably. So there are many things that exist in the universe that are above this. But more generally, what you can imagine is that dark matter could still be something heavier than this, but it would have to be some sort of composite state. So there are various types of systems people talk about. I mean, the simplest one is dark matter could itself just be a black hole. And this is these ideas of primordial black holes I mentioned in previous lectures is a very plausible possibility for dark matter. I'll say a few words about this in a bit. But otherwise, it could just be some very complicated composite state. So for instance, we were talking about BBN briefly in the last lectures. I mean, the reason, just to tell you, the reason why we don't form arbitrarily heavy nuclei from BBN is because of the electrostatic repulsion of the protons we're trying to put into this. As you try and put more and more of them in, there's more electrostatic repulsion, and it just can't happen in the early universe. You need much more violent events, like in a supernova, for instance. However, you could imagine, what if you had some dark sector state, which was strongly coupled like QCD, but there just wasn't a U1 like we have in E and M? Well, then actually you could just start making bigger and bigger and bigger states in the early universe. And actually the only thing that would stop these states becoming arbitrarily large is that the universe is expanding. So people have written down models of that variety where you end up with massive composite states, maybe the individual constituents of order GeV, but you can end up with the composite particles that are much, much heavier than the Planck scale. And these are collectively called blobs or nuggets. I don't really like either of them, but that is what they're called.
Small question.
Please, yeah.
Let's say that dark matter particle correspondence, I'm sorry, dark matter black hole correspondence, do you still assume that the particle picture has a spin there?
Well, for black holes, I mean, they can have spin, right?
Yeah.
But there's like we know what they can have, right? They can have charge, spin, mass, right? Yeah, yeah. So definitely you can have this as well. And actually one of the things people think about is what is the spin distribution you would expect for primordial black holes? And maybe this might be some way you could distinguish them from the black holes that we expect to be produced astrophysically. Maybe you get a very different spin distribution. So it is certainly an interesting thing to think about. So let me just say a few words about primordial black holes. Because it's a very active topic at the moment. Indeed, you may have seen. I highly doubt this was discussed in your first lecture this morning, but there were papers written at the time, or maybe it was, but there were papers written at the time of the first LIGO discovery entitled, Did LIGO Detect Dark Matter? In the sense that people were wondering whether it was possible, like of these order 10 solar mass black holes that LIGO first discovered, maybe they were actually primordial black holes. Now, in terms of the entire range over which primordial black holes could exist, it seems very disappointing that they might just happen to exist at a range where we can easily, well, not necessarily easily, but we could plausibly produce astrophysical black holes, but nonetheless, people thought about that possibility for a while. So I think that's partly why this field has gotten reinvigorated, because of the LIGO discovery. So how these black holes we imagine being produced is that, well, we know that they can't be stellar remnants, because we've already seen that from the CMB, that dark matter had to be in place. And at that time, all the regular matter was certainly not collapsed into stars. So instead, what these need to be is that the general picture is that there's some large overdensities you somehow produced in the early universe that just collapse instantly and formed a black hole. How you generically generate these is challenging. This is sort of one of the dirty laundry of these types of models, how exactly you generate this. But there are mechanisms people have talked about in the literature. I just want to say briefly what the landscape looks like for this. So let me put the mass of the PBH down here. One solar mass. These units are all over the place. I don't know why I chose them, but here we go. Got one here. And so what I'm plotting on the x-axis is what is the mass of the primordial black hole in solar masses, going from 1 down to 10 to the minus 16 here. And then what I'm putting on the right is what is the fraction of dark matter that could be in the primordial black holes. Now, if primordial black holes are dark matter, this better be 1. But as I set stronger constraints, I could exclude the possibility that it's 1, and it'll have to be one of these scenarios like the cocktail model I mentioned earlier on, where you could have primordial black holes, they just can't be all of dark matter. So at the low end here, this region is excluded because as I make these black holes lighter and lighter, I actually end up making them hotter and hotter, and they Hawking radiate. And I can go and look for that Hawking radiation because, for example, it'll produce high-energy gamma rays. And we have very good gamma ray telescopes. We don't see an enormous amount of gamma rays emerging from where we think dark matter is. And so this comes from the Hawking radiation constraints on this. In fact, if you make them lighter and lighter, eventually these black holes would have just dissipated in the age of the universe. So that's also a constraint you can get. But we can do better by looking for the Hawking radiation and not seeing it. Next, starting at about 10 to the minus 10. So this one cuts in it. This is why I've drawn this at 10 to the minus 16. I don't know why I'm trying to be so precise with this. There's this funny shape bound here. And what this is coming from is microlensing. In particular, if the dark matter is made up of a whole bunch of compact objects, well, if I go and look at some distant star, it doesn't even need to be that distance, like cosmologically, maybe I just look at a star, say, in one of these satellite galaxies I mentioned. Famously, they do this by looking at the Large Magellanic Cloud. Well, in between myself and the star in the Large Magellanic Cloud, there's a lot of dark matter. But this is made up of these compact objects. So as these pass by the star, they'll lead to, there'll be gravitational lensing of this. And actually what you specifically get is something called microlensing, where the brightness of the star will just be blipping. So people can look for this with very sensitive instruments. They don't see anything. And it turns out they can set the constraint that's showing you here. And so that means it's still possible that there's a window from about 10 to the minus 16 to 10 to the minus 10 where primordial black holes can be all of the dark matter, but not above that because of these bounds. Please.
Why this like weird form of that curve? Like, I would expect like that it decreases or increases coming up, just then down again.
No, it's a good question. I honestly don't recall off the top of my head. The thing I'm wondering about, and I should double check this, is it may be two different experimental results that have been glued together, but I may be incorrect with that. So I would have to double check. You may be correct that there's multiple surveys that have been glued together, or there could be some physical reason here, but nothing's coming to mind. So it's a good question. I don't exactly remember. I mean, if you want to read more about this, someone who's written 100 papers on primordial black holes is Carr, and he had a recent review on this topic where I think I pulled this from. So if you want to find where I got this. And then if you go to the very highest masses, there's bounds that cut in very sharply. And this is actually a very interesting process for what's happening here. If we go back to some of these dwarf galaxies that I talked about earlier on, we recently discovered a dwarf galaxy that is orbiting the Milky Way, but is actually outside the dark matter halo. I think it's like 250 kiloparsecs away. So it's very distant, but it's still orbiting the Milky Way. And within that galaxy, we see a whole bunch of stars, something called a star cluster, very close to the dynamical center of this system. Now, if dark matter was made up of order solar mass particles, so heavier particles than the stars that are in this system, there is this process that again was discovered by Chandrasekhar called dynamical heating, where as these particles move past each other, they'll slowly transfer some of their kinetic energy to the stars in that system, and it happens very efficiently when the mass of the dark matter is heavier than the mass of the stars, and you'll slowly heat this system up such that it will puff up. And the fact that we see this galaxy exist and the stars are quite close to the center means that the dark matter can't have a mass that's much larger than the solar mass yet. There's a lot of beautiful physics in this. I'm not doing justice, but this comes from us dynamical friction dynamical friction, I believe is the term. And then generally, I mean, this argument I've told it in the language of primordial black holes, but for example, this heating argument here completely excludes that any composite dark matter larger than a solar mass could be what's going on here, because otherwise you would also heat up these systems. And there are other bounds that kick in higher up. So this is giving you a flavor. It's still plausible that dark matter, for example, could be made of primordial black holes in this narrow mass window. But there are various ways that we have of probing this. And hopefully, I mean, there's six orders of magnitude left here to cover, but it's much smaller than the maybe 81 or whatever it was, 87 orders of magnitude we began with. We're slowly covering some of this down. Good. So that's what I wanted to say about heavy dark matter. What I want to turn to now is the light end and discuss wave dark matter, but let me pause again in case there's any questions. Also, while I look for an eraser. Good. So what I want to turn to now is something that is called wave dark matter, and this is where we move much to the left of the classic window we talked about earlier. And one of the first things I want to address is why do people call this wave dark matter in particular? So the first thing I want to compute is, recall yesterday we started out with an observation, which is that we locally know that there's about one proton per centimeter cubed of dark matter mass, and then for a given dark matter particle mass, we know how many dark matter particles there are per centimeter cubed. But this, I mean, a centimeter, although it's a unit we use day to day, is not a really fundamental unit in nature in any sense. So actually a more natural unit to describe is one that we were actually discussing earlier, which is how many particles are there within the natural size of that particle? Because particles have some intrinsic spatial scale associated with them, it's the de Broglie wavelength. So how many particles are there within this? Or in other words, another way of thinking about this is, are these states overlapping or not? And if they are, how much are they overlapping? And the fact that we're well below the Tremaine gum bound tells you that you might expect them to start to be overlapping. Good. So what I want to do is compute this number density of dark matter, which we computed yesterday. So I'll draw on that result. I'm going to multiply this. So this is the number of particles I have per particle volume. So that's the physical number density multiplied by the volume that associated with that particle, which is the de Broglie wavelength cubed. So if I put these together, this is, I can rewrite the number density in terms of something we can measure, which is the energy density, rho chi, but then I have to divide by a factor of mass. And then just to remind you, the de Broglie wavelength is 1 over the mass times the velocity for a non-relativistic particle. I'm now moving back to setting h bar and c to be 1. Good. So then on the denominator, I have mass to the fourth, 1 extra power because I've moved from n to rho, and I have the velocity cubed. But then if you recall from last time, I know what the velocity of dark matter is. If I compute this locally, I know it's in natural units around 10 to the minus 3, or in other words, it's around 200 kilometers a second. So I can actually compute this. And I find, of course, it will depend on the dark matter mass. But for a dark matter mass of order 10 eV, I find that this is 1. So what happens then if the dark matter mass is much, much lower than 10 eV? Well, then I find that the number of particles per state is much, much larger than 1. And because of wave-particle duality, I can move to a picture where it's much more appropriate to describe this system of energy that I have here, this energy density, as a wave rather than as a particle. But of course, that's deeply hand-waving. Like, why this comes out, I'll say some words about this later on, but maybe intuitively you can imagine this occurring. To give you some more, another way of thinking about this, this same transition we know happens in the electromagnetic spectrum. For example, for the very highest energies, when we're talking about electromagnetic radiation, we think of gamma rays. And you don't think of gamma rays as some oscillating wave, you think of them as a particle flying throughout the universe that can crash into your detector. But when we go down to radio, we absolutely think about what we're having there as a wave. And indeed, the difference is that there's not the correct term, but I'll just push forward, that the mass of the photon has changed. Now, what's happened, the energy has changed, was the analog of what you should be computing here. So similarly, if I make the mass of the system lighter and lighter and lighter, I'm going to have the same transition in dark matter. And that transition happens at around 10 eV. So essentially, when I'm looking down at this lower end, really what I should be thinking about dark matter as being is a wave. Please.
Is there a constraint coming from a Fermi nature of these particles? They are too much in the same space, they should be too much.
Absolutely. No, you're exactly right. There is a constraint, and it's the Tremaine gun bound, which tells me that whatever this is, it must be a boson. Right. So exactly right. So whatever this dark matter is down here, it has to be a boson. So that's something fundamental that we know about wave-like dark matter.
Any assumption or making about the self-interaction of dark matter particles here?
Not here. I mean, to give you another example of this, I can still describe radio as a wave, even though, I mean, light does interact at a very, very small rate, but it's completely negligible for my ability to describe it as a wave. So similarly here, you could add self-interactions in, but that's not necessary for me to describe this picture as a wave. I can ignore the self-interactions of the light coming out of that light bulb there, but I can still accurately describe it as a wave. Yeah. So let's actually compute, because it turns out to give us one of the bounds, let's actually compute what this de Broglie wavelength is, just to put a number on it. And here's one I did offline. If I make the dark matter mass 10 to the minus 22 electron volts, and I give the dark matter a velocity of 10 kilometers a second, so smaller than what we have locally, then the de Broglie wavelength is 2 kiloparsecs. Okay? So this thing is enormous, right? I mean, this is an astrophysical-sized object. Why have I gone to 10 kilometers a second rather than order 100 kilometers a second? Well, let's imagine we're studying this system in a dwarf, one of these galaxies orbiting our own Milky Way. They're less massive, And so when I apply the virial theorem to that, the dark matter particles will be moving less quickly. It turns out they're moving at order 10 kilometers a second. And then what I'm doing is I'm just trying to see what happens if I make this lighter and lighter and lighter. So for example, you probably can't push it arbitrarily light. If you push it, I think, to roughly 10 to the minus 31, then this dark matter has a wavelength that is of order the size of the observable universe. And at that point, it's very hard to imagine how you end up producing the structures that we see around us. But in particular, given that we see structures like these dwarf galaxies, which are of order kiloparsecs in size, it's very hard, well, I mean, you can sit down and do the calculations, it's impossible, to imagine that they could be described with particles with such a large wavelength. You just end up washing out structure at scales much smaller than the natural wavelength of this particle that you're describing here. Now, this is a very hand-waving argument. Of course, people then do much more careful calculations and argue about them indefinitely. Ultimately, so this would suggest that 10 to the minus 22 is in trouble. It has to be heavier than that. But I've put here 10 to the minus 21. Other authors would say 10 to the minus 19. The fact that this thing has some wavelength can imprint itself on various different measurements we have of the universe where structure emerges. And I think that the strongest bounds people claim are of order 10 to the minus 19, but it is debated. In fact, I think you're going to have a lecture. I think you are going to have a lecture Friday next week by Luna, who will be talking about axion dark matter. And Luna's a real expert on wave-like dark matter at this lower end. So I defer exactly what that value is to Luna's talk. But it's somewhere around there. Good, so as I was going to mention now, but this was already brought up in one of the questions, we know that whatever this is, it has to be a boson, but there's various possibilities for this. It could be a scalar, it could be a pseudoscalar, it could be a vector. This is the example of dark photons, and people consider each of those possibilities, for instance. So let me say some words about how we're going to describe this. And be very rough, this is something that in the lecture on axions, I wanted to dig into maybe a little bit more, but there's really a lot that could be said about this. Like, how do I make this picture that this thing is a wave more accurate? But very loosely, using phi, because this has to be some boson, instead of thinking about a gas of particles, what I can think about is I have some wave, very loosely, that is just oscillating as some cosine. And then it'll have, and then some phase. And maybe just to get you some intuition for this, I've put some prefactor here. This has to have mass dimension 1. This has mass dimension 4. So the square root has mass dimension 2 divided by minus 1. So this has the right mass dimension, but you know, how did I get this? Where did this factor of 2 come in? You can confirm this by computing the energy momentum tensor for this object. And the local energy density in this system better be the dark matter energy density, or it's not going to be a very good dark matter candidate. So that one of the things that I think is most exciting about wave dark matter is that for decades, people have been looking for the possibility that there's this gas of dark matter that's passing through their detector and maybe it leaves some sort of imprint. Or you have particles of dark matter colliding with each other out in the cosmos and annihilating, or I produce this particle at a collider. I mean, this is something we've just been looking for ages and ages and ages. But now the fundamental description of dark matter is some oscillating cosine. I mean, the way that we're going to look for it is going to be dramatically different. In particular, any one dark matter particle is going to have so little energy associated with it, you really can't imagine easily looking for it to scatter, or even if it's absorbed, to produce any significant response. Instead, what you're going to need to leverage is that if maybe this thing is coupled somehow to the standard model, it might also induce some oscillating pattern in the standard model thing that it's coupled to. And so broadly, what people look for is some sort of driving effect being created through a coupling of this wave to some standard model effect. But you can imagine that this is dramatically different to what people have been looking for decades. And in fact, this is why it's been such an exciting field to think about, because there's many new opportunities in terms of searching for ways that the dark matter could emerge, which is beyond what people have thought about for a long time.
Excuse me. that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's like a constraint from structures in dwarf galaxies for this type of dark matter.
Yeah.
There is the same constraint for earlier universe, I mean.
This is partly related to where people argue about this. I mean, there's various times where we see some of the smaller structures in the universe. There's another probe, which you may have heard of, if not, have a look at, called Lyman Alpha, where we observe very small structures in the early universe. And this is one of the reasons, like, how trustworthy are those Lyman Alpha bounds is partly how people argue about what you're seeing here. But broadly, actually what it ends up, it's not the same, but what it ends up being is very similar to hot dark matter. Hot dark matter has some velocity, which means small structures can't collapse because the dark matter has a higher velocity than the escape velocity of those systems. So you wash out smaller structures. Here, you also wash out smaller structures. So a lot of the techniques that people have used to constrain hot dark matter can turn around and also be used to constrain some of these. They're not exactly the same, but they're similar in spirit. So as many different ways as people had of that, you also have had of this. There's a vast literature beyond just this dwarf. I mean, this dwarf gives me the weakest sort of version of this bound, but again, by thinking hard, I can do better. Yeah.
Can you tell them what is that number in solar mass?
Excellent. So a solar mass is 10 to the 57 GeV, so it's 10 to the 66 EV, right? And so this is 10 to the minus 22, so it's 10 to the minus 88 solar masses. Yeah. Right? And I told you that the parameter space was 87 orders of magnitude because I started one higher. Yeah. Anyway, good. I mean, yeah, I use that conversion regularly. Yeah, very good. So let me just say some words about this. I'm not going to give you a completely satisfactory answer to this. I'm very happy to talk about this offline. But I think one of the things that perturbs me a bit when people talk about wave-like dark matter is that you often just say, oh, this happens for, you know, for the electromagnetic spectrum, so something like a cosine should come out. But I'm sort of left wondering why exactly is that the case. So let me just give you some slightly more intuition about why you might expect this thing to be described as essentially a cosine. So one slightly flippant answer to this is that, well, of course, that's not a completely nuts thing to write down because it solves the classical equation of motion for this system here, right? Squared, of course. So putting this in is at least going to satisfy the equations of motion I get out of this if I don't need to worry about various loop corrections, et cetera, which in some models you might imagine have to be small because the various couplings are small. So, okay, it passes that sort of sanity check. Another reason to see why such a thing emerges is that you can imagine that one of the defining features of what occurs in quantum mechanics is that, oh God, I'm gonna get these the wrong way around, right? But A and A dagger don't commute. So rather than worrying about getting the sign right, we know that that's not zero. But also the magnitude of these systems here is the number operator, like how many states I have in the system. And so what I can imagine is the fact that these don't commute is gonna become less and less of a problem as I have more and more states in there. Again, this is slightly hand-waving, but it's less hand-waving than the original description. And so what I might imagine is that the system ends up in a somewhat like approximately classical type state. But if I want to describe that from the quantum level, I have to give you an example of what that state is. And sort of, if you might remember from your discussions of the simple harmonic oscillator, the most classical state is the coherent state. So you could imagine, well, what if dark matter was in the coherent state? Let me use another board. What would you get then? Some of you may not have seen this. If so, I'm happy to talk about this offline. So we imagine that dark matter is in a coherent state, which is an eigenstate of the annihilation operator with some C number or complex number alpha. And then the other thing to note from this is that we can compute what is the expected number of states, and it's going to be controlled by this alpha. So the magnitude of alpha squared is going to tell us how many states that we have, which is something that we can in principle compute using the techniques that I've, the rough numbers that I was giving to you earlier on. So of course you can keep track of the phase, but I just want to do a simple estimate here. So let me just take this number to be real and imagine that it's in a, we're in a coherent state where the size of alpha is just the square root of the number of the particles we have here. So if this is the quantum state of the system, I can start asking about what would I expect to observe for this bosonic field. And in particular, what you would want to do is you'd want to determine the expectation value of just the scalar field operator, which is given as follows. So if we're trying to understand, you know, what this bosonic field is doing, we have to look at what the expectation value is of this field, assuming that it's in this classical coherent state. So I'm just wedging this between the state that it's in, which is this alpha. And let me just assume this thing's non-relativistic and keep track of just the mass and the phase here. Okay, and then I can use the fact that I know how alpha acts on these states here. Acts with these operators, how the operators act on the state, sorry. What I end up with is 2 over V. So I've got a square root of n when I've acted on this out here, because I assumed that that's what the value of alpha is. And where have I got this? And then what I've done for future convenience is I've pulled a half out of here. So if I put this back in, that the 2 will make sense again. And then all I have left is the phase factors. Okay. And then obviously we know what this is here. This is just the complex exponential representation of a cosine. So this is literally cosine m chi t. And then what do we have for the prefactor here? Well, n over v is exactly the number density of the dark matter, and that is equal to the mass density, which we can measure, over m chi. So I'm going to get 2 factors of m chi here squared. I can pull that out of the square root, and what I'm going to get, this was worth keeping track of the factors of 2. So if this system is in this quite classical state, you end up finding that the expectation value of the scalar field operator, again, exactly matches this factor up to all of the prefactors that you have, which I find quite satisfying. You can then ask questions like, what are higher moments of this? You can compute that. And the naive difficulty you usually have with this is you need to worry about the commutation of A and A dagger, but the effects that you would get from this are going to be suppressed because they're going to be much smaller than the factor of N that you would get from the order of magnitude of A and A dagger combined together. Good. So that was the last thing I wanted to say about wave dark matter for lecture 2, and we're almost at the end of lecture 3, and that's on me. But let me pause at this point to see if there's any questions about that derivation. I'll pull this down so it can be seen.
And why are we just considering one, I don't know if that's an energy eigenstate, or we could sum over different k's.
Yeah.
We could have different phases for each. Why are we doing this?
So the energy I can add, no. So to firstly say, this is less hand waving than the original description, but it's still, I wave my hands at various points. Like, why is this in the coherent state, for example? I say it's the most classical state, but I mean, another question that you could have is, why is this in a pure state? Instead, you would probably imagine that it's in some mixed state. And there's a good answer to this. It was what was determined by Glauber in the 1960s when he wrote down the original paper introducing the coherent state to describe how do we think about the quantum nature of light, for example. So this is a very rich topic that I really didn't want to dive into here because it takes me a bit of field. But just to say, there's a lot, again, going on under the hood here, for example. And the place to look is Glauber's original paper on this topic, I think, to really, because how do we describe the quantum mechanical nature of wave-like dark matter, of light, is going to be very similar to how we would describe the quantum mechanical nature of wave-like dark matter. So you need to worry about these sorts of things. And in general, I wouldn't expect dark matter to be in a pure state. But this basic property is still going to hold. There's going to be corrections to this, but you're still not going to be that different from that. You also asked about the energy distribution. We know for dark matter it's non-relativistic. So the dominant description of the energy distribution is the mass. Okay, how do I get corrections to this? This is what I will talk about in the lecture on axions if I get there. But yeah, that is something you also need to worry about. But again, because this is non-relativistic, I'm getting the dominant description by covering here. Like, the oscillation frequency of a system is set by its energy, and for a non-relativistic state, it's dominated by the mass. That's right. Other questions? Please.
What is the denominator under the square root of 2?
Excellent. Yes, it is. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. I think one benefit of my handwriting is it really makes you think about what's going on. And that is the end of the list of benefits of my handwriting. Yeah, good. Any other questions? Good. Okay, so that was the end of lecture two. And just to summarize the perspective, like, we've also covered what was the most important part of these lectures, which is sort of a summary of what we know about dark matter. Lecture one told us that there is this additional substance throughout the universe, and there's extremely compelling evidence that it's the dominant source of matter that we have in the universe. And so historically, people came up with many ideas for what they could be, and slowly they were excluded until we were left with just this particle picture. But unfortunately, I mean, the story is not as resolved as we might like, because there's an enormous range of masses over which the dark matter could exist. I've told you roughly what are the physical principles dictating some of these boundaries. At each one of these, I think this has really been drawn out in the questions. There's a lot more that you could dive into. But the other factor I hopefully you've got some impression for is that the way that you would search for the dark matter changes dramatically as you look across this wider energy range. And why I think this is quite an exciting time for the field is that historically people were really focused on the possibility that dark matter had a mass of order of GeV for good reasons, I think. However, it's only more recently that we've really opened up the possibility, and as we're starting to look at these new search strategies, maybe there was just some simple possibility we just missed, and maybe one of these new techniques that we're driving into will lead to a discovery of dark matter in the coming years. That's a very exciting possibility, but also the possibility remains that we just haven't thought of the best idea yet. So I think that's why you want to keep this in mind. So what I wanted to do next is to tell you about why you shouldn't give up on the WIMP just yet. Although I think many people have. So there's an argument that you could give that this is not a very interesting thing to discuss, although I still think that there's some interesting parts in here. And the other thing I could start talking about, although maybe I won't even get through that, is to dive a bit more into this wave-like description and talk about this specific hypothesis of wave-like dark matter, where it's a pseudoscalar particle called the axion, and sort of tell you about how people are trying to make this picture more rigorous and actually look for this. So I'm happy to take a vote. Is there any preference in here for hearing more about WIMPs?
I think I'm too much of a WIMP for data.
Very good, thank you. Yeah, yeah. And for axions, or people just don't want to hear anything? Okay, yeah. Okay, good. So I will leave you one thing about the WIMP, though, because I think... ultimately, I'm in charge. Yeah. But I just want to, I think you're all a little down on the WIMP, so I'll just leave one homework exercise for you to understand. And I'm very happy to chat about this offline. But if you're really interested in dark matter and you want to get some flavor for why did people work on this for decades, I think there's this calculation that, I mean, I could do on the board, but I don't think it's anywhere near as good as if you just went through and computed it yourself. And this is... understanding something called the WIMP miracle, which is that the WIMP can very nicely fit into this picture we had of the early universe and end up, for the masses that we'd already wanted to have of order of TeV, exactly nail what is the observed relic abundance of dark matter, which in many other models is really just something that you have to put in as a parameter. You don't have some deep satisfying explanation for why dark matter has the observed abundance that it does. So, so remember that we talked about the WIMP. It has some, it can annihilate to center model particles. And as a function of that, the annihilation cross-section, you should show that the abundance of dark matter you produce is about 0.1, which is the exactly observed value. If you have a cross-section that is exactly what you would have, this is 10 to the minus 3. If you had for a weakly coupled particle with a mass of order a TeV. And so what I'd like you to do is just to derive that. And I mean, you don't need to necessarily come up with this ahead of time because it's been done thousands of times. But for example, if you look in this famous book of Kolben Turner, they work through this very carefully in section 5.2. So I do think if you're very interested in this, it's a worthwhile calculation to go through to understand like where you end up with this. But what you find is that for annihilation cross-section, for some particle that couples to the weak force, which we would expect from a supersymmetric state, that has a mass of order of TeV, you get exactly the right relic abundance. Which is, I mean, if this is actually how the universe worked, would have been deeply satisfying. I mean, many of the versions of this model have now been excluded, so many people have moved on, but I still think this original, like, simple cosmology is compelling. And this is the reason I haven't completely given up on the WIMP, and maybe I'll pull one or two of you back if you do that calculation. Okay, so with that said, that's all I'm going to say about the WIMP. I'll next turn to axion dark matter.
I mean, it's probably worth saying it's many millions of dollars being invested.
Absolutely. No. Yeah, I feel there's this tension in the field in the following way. Getting down to this is exactly with the direct detection, which we talked about, is one of the best ways of probing the WIMP. And there's still interesting parts of the parameter space. Let me, an excuse to say more about the WIMP. There are interesting parts of the parameter space that have yet to be reached. And part of the challenge here, though, is that because we've been searching for it for decades, to reach the parts we haven't reached already, it's not low-hanging fruit. It's usually some enormously complicated instrument that we need that can be very expensive to go into. Now, I think as a field, it's very important that we continue to support this and we continue to look for this possibility because it's a very plausible one. However, I also see, I mean, there's... For a younger member of the community looking to join this, there's some, you know, offset. Sometimes you want to join some massive collaboration that has a very well-defined research program and be an important part of that large collaboration, or do you want to forge out on your own and do something completely new? And I think often, you know, people coming into the field choose the latter option. I think that's part of why some of these other ideas like the axion pop up. But I would also say the axion has no satisfying explanation in my mind. Maybe people disagree with this for why we get the observed relic abundance. It's just, well, the parameters in the model had to be such a way that comes out, for example. That's what I would say about this. But yeah, I'm happy to talk a lot more about the WIMP over lunch or otherwise. Good. With that said, let me turn to this next possibility, which is studying this idea of axion dark matter. I will certainly not get through this in the next 10 minutes, but we'll continue this on Monday morning. So I mean, there's a lot of things you can say about the axion. And I think one of the reasons people are so excited about it is it has a very interesting UV motivation, which is that it can solve this other outstanding problem that we have in the standard model, the strong CP problem. And also has a very interesting cosmology. I mean, maybe it can't nail this point one that we observe, but there's still a lot of interesting aspects of what the axion could be doing in the early universe, and also how a particle that would be as light as 10 to the minus 21 or something like this could actually be a cold dark matter candidate, how this can work out. I will say some words about this and also give you some intuitive picture, but I will not be going through the detailed calculations of how those work. I'll be pointing you to references, because what I ultimately want to get to in my time is to think, if such a thing exists and locally we have this oscillating wave of dark matter, how would we detect it? So that's the part I'm most excited about, because it's very nice that you can do these calculations about what's in the early universe, but I really want to know what dark matter is, so I want to come to the detection part. So I'll be focusing on what I think is the most well-motivated or well-discussed candidate for wave dark matter, but many of the things I'll be describing can actually be lifted to other dark matter candidates, although in certain cases there are caveats to that. So So in this lecture, which will be today and on Monday, I'll talk briefly about axion cosmology. How do we fit this particle of the axion into this picture I had of a brief history of time in the first lecture, in the second lecture it was. I'll say some words about why it's so well motivated, this thing called the QCD axion, how it can solve the strong CP problem, but I'll be very brief in these. And then what I really want to focus on is how you could detect it. Good, so let's just jump straight into this, and I'll start talking about axion cosmology. Or in particular, what could this state be doing in the early universe, and how could we end up imagining it behaves like cold dark matter? So again, I'm going to be very rough on this, but if you'd like to see a lot more details, there's many wonderful references. The one that I've used regularly is that there's a paper by David Marsh called Axion Cosmology. So that's an easy one to find. They go through a lot of these things in detail. Good, so the usual picture we have for the axion is that at some light, well, by definition, it's a pseudo-scalar, and then it's a pseudo-Goldstone particle. So I'll break these down. Why are these properties we would want for this state? You can also think about dark matter being a scalar rather than a pseudo-scalar. But the challenges that these sorts of models often run into is that if you have some scalar that is extremely light, it will source long-range interactions if it couples to regular matter between them. And it's very hard to get rid of that. So if you want to have some coupling to regular matter because you want to detect it, well, usually it's very hard for that coupling to be at a level where you're not already excluded from the fact that such a particle would essentially change the interaction strength of gravity that we have. Now, that's not exclusively true. There are certainly cases where you can have a scalar dark matter that is weakly enough coupled that you could and still see something in the lab, but this is a generic challenge you have. If instead this particle is a pseudoscalar, it doesn't source long-range interactions in the same way, and so it's not as challenging there. So this is one reason you might want to focus on this. Why would you want it to be a pseudo-Goldstone boson? Well, ideally, you want some explanation as to why this particle is so light and why it's natural that it has a mass that it does down there. If it's not a Goldstone boson, it's difficult to understand why it doesn't end up with a much larger mass when it starts coupling to other particles in the Standard Model, for instance. So there's different ways that we could imagine the axion emerging. There's a long story about how generically axions emerge from string theory that I'm happy to discuss, but I'm not going to say many words on. But then the conventional mechanism, if we're thinking about this as a Goldstone boson, is not so different, for example, when you're talking about the Higgs mechanism, which I know you went through with in Brian's lectures. And so the conventional UV picture is the axion is the pseudo-Goldstone boson from some U1 symmetry, which is conventionally called Peche-Quinn symmetry, after the first authors that studied this. And the scale at which this Peche-Quinn symmetry is emerged, is usually called FA, F with a subscript A for the axion. So with this in mind, we can go, if we know that this is happening at some scale FA, we can go through a very rough picture for what the evolution of this system would look like in the early universe. And this picture I'm about to tell you is something called the misalignment mechanism, essentially, which is the analog of the WIMP miracle or the thermal cosmology for the WIMP particles I asked you to have a look at. Is there any questions on the setup, please?
Yeah, what exactly defines like a pseudo-Goldstone boson? Is this just like for a pseudo-scalar?
Good, if it's a literal Goldstone, no, good question. If it's a literal Goldstone boson, it's massless. But then this thing, to be dark matter, it better have a mass. So something is going to have to break whatever symmetry was keeping it massless in order to do this, and there's various ways of doing that. So we know that dark matter has to be a mass, so we want it. The Goldstone can still protect its mass being light, but the fact that it's not literally zero, because then it wouldn't be a good dark matter candidate, means it has to be pseudo.
Okay.
Yeah, good question.
So it's like kind of approximately Goldstone boson.
Yes, yeah. We have many examples of this, like in the standard model, the pions, the pseudo Goldstone bosons, right? So, please.
What's the distinction between axions and ALPS?
Oof. So for me, nothing. I mean, this is a semantic thing, but I think in the literature, so just for people who haven't heard of this terminology before, there's axions and then there's axion-like particles. Anyway, I mean, it's better than the blobs and the nuggets, but it's the language, it's the language that we're stuck with. In the literature, sometimes people, when they say axions, they refer specifically to an axion that solves the strong CP problem. So that is what they mean by an axion. And an ALP is a pseudoscalar boson of this sort of variety, but it doesn't necessarily solve the strong CP problem. In any paper I've ever written on this, I just call it axion, because that's what I mean here. But it's a good thing to raise, because if you look in the literature, people sometimes are very careful about that distinction. I won't be. Yeah. Please.
How many
suitable
bosons are we looking for?
Here, just one. We just want one particle to make up the dark matter. This is the axion we're looking for. I'm just breaking one U1, so I'll get one Goldstone associated with that, and that's what's going to be the dark matter. Could you cook up a much more complicated model? Yes, but let me just start with this here. So let's, in the next 2 minutes, let me just draw some pictures, because I've established that I'm very good at that. And these things are very hard to draw, but anyway, let me just leave it like that. So what I want to study is just roughly what is happening to where this axion is emerging as a function of the history of the universe. And so I imagine if the universe is at very, very high temperatures, well above this scale FA, so it's step one, well, the thing isn't broken. So I can roughly think that there's some potential that looks like this. So for example, this is the value of phi, this is the value of V of phi. Usually this, we're normally taking this to be a complex scalar, so this is a three-dimensional plot that I'm not drawing here. But at this stage, this system is just sitting at the minimum here. And then what is going to happen, though, at some point, this symmetry will be broken, and we'll translate from this in step two. When we go below the symmetry breaking scale, we will have the wine bottle potential, which you would have already discussed, I'm sure. And of course, this is three-dimensional, which is what I'm trying to draw. And what will happen is that this field, just by spontaneous symmetry breaking, will fall to some random value on this circle. Okay, no particular value was chosen out, but some value will be obtained. But at this stage, the fluctuations around this circle here are completely massless. There's no energy associated with moving around this. So this is while this field is still massless. At some point, normally in the case of the QCD axion, it happens around the QCD phase transition, which will be much lower than the scale of FA we associate, that this particle gets a mass. Or at some point, because it's a very light particle, which is much lighter than the scale FA, we'll reach a point where the mass is relevant, and we'll notice actually all of the minima here are not literally degenerate. Because if it was, it couldn't have a mass. So one way of thinking about this is when the mass turns on, you have to tilt this wine bottle slightly. So this is absolutely testing my drawing capacities, but I'll try this out. So the point three, whenever we hit the mass, in the QCD axion, that's at the QCD scale, but otherwise it depends on where exactly that mass is and what it comes from. This will be slightly tilted. I'm nervous even starting, anyway. And what's interesting about this is that now this thing is slightly tilted, you can imagine that, okay, we didn't have to, where we started initially, we don't have to be where the minimum is. If it's tilted, there will be some minimum. But if we started, say, out here, and the minimum's literally there, this field will now be driven to move down towards the minimum of its potential. It'll slightly overshoot. And instead, it'll just start oscillating around the minimum that we've established here. And what you can imagine is at once this mass has been turned on, there is some potential energy associated with where we started in terms of where we fell down in the minimum here. So this is the heart of the misalignment mechanism. There's some random point we end up going when we go through the symmetry breaking. But then because there's no reason that that's going to be the exact minimum here, there's going to be some energy density, some potential energy associated with the oscillations that are going here. So one second. So that's a very qualitative picture. I mean, one other way of just realizing this is if I do a 2D projection of what you're seeing here, and this is what the potential will look like. This is the minimum associated with the mass, but it's periodic. And we just ended up at some random point here, and then we're going to start to fall down and oscillate. So there's some energy density in the system if it's gone through this through these three steps. The question that I'll come to on Monday is that energy density associated with that field, does that obey any of the properties you would expect of dark matter? And I think one of the surprising things that we'll find out of the calculation is that the oscillations of this system around the minimum here behave exactly the way that cold dark matter should, which I think a priori is maybe not what you would have expected, and this is the reason why these ultralight wave-like candidates can actually be a cold dark matter. So let me take this question and then I'll end for today, please.
Yeah, I wanted to understand from the Higgs point of view too, like how we work with the Higgs, to have this kind of, let's say, decay of this particle, do we need to consider an imaginary part of the potential?
So for this, I mean, essentially this depends on what type of, you're asking like what type of phase transition I'm going through here.
No, like.
Because there's no, if it's just.
If it's stable, you need an imaginary contribution. That's why I wanted to.
I may be forgetting part of what you're talking about, like, but when you go through these phase transitions, of course, famously, there's two possibilities, right? You could end up in a situation where the old minimum, there's a deeper one, but you have to tunnel to get there, or you can end up in the case where you can just smoothly just fall down. The description I'm talking about is the second one here, where this is the one where I need to worry about the imaginary part, right? Or maybe I'm missing your point. Okay, no worries. No, thanks. I guess before, is there any other urgent questions? Otherwise, I'll be standing here afterwards until we go to lunch. But I'm not seeing any, so let me leave it there. Thanks, everyone.